All right, so now we're going to introduce Scott Bechtold from the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences, and he's going to be talking about From Watersheds to the Sea in Puget Sound, the Inferred Dynamics of Chemical Export.
The occurrence of hypoxia in marine waters has become an increasing concern in recent years. Large areas of the Gulf of Mexico, Asia, and more locally in the Puget Sound area, there's several areas that are subject to seasonal low dissolved oxygen concentrations. Most famously in Hood Canal, where if you look at the color here, the increasing red indicates low dissolved oxygen. And you can see it declines as you move down in the late summer through Hood Canal into the Lynch Cove area down in the boot there. Lynch Cove area has experienced fish kills on half a dozen occasions in the past decade during late summer. This is thought to be partly a natural occurrence due to the low circulation of water in the Hood Canal area, but it's also thought that humans play a part in this, especially due to the increasing prevalence of these fish kills. And so the Hood Canal Dissolved Oxygen Program was established in 2003 to evaluate the sources of the low dissolved oxygen concentrations and to suggest remedial measures. And it's a two-pronged strategy. One group looking at the marine waters, doing measurements. There's a set of buoys located in the Hood Canal collecting data on dissolved oxygen, phytoplankton, temperature, and other variables even as we speak. And then there's an extensive modeling effort. A lot of attention has been focused on the terrestrial sources. Early on, it was determined that nitrogen is likely the problem. There's a strong marine source, but the euphotic layer in the marine areas become depleted in nitrogen early in spring, and there are several terrestrial sources of nitrogen enrichment that could possibly contribute to increased phytoplankton activity in the canal, leading to low dissolved oxygen concentrations when the phytoplankton dies and decomposes. And we've been following a two-pronged strategy in the terrestrial, collecting measurements from streams and rivers, and then also doing computer modeling. The three sources that we identified that we think are likely contributing to the nitrogen loading of Hood Canal. The first is red alder. Red alder is a native species. It's a disturbance species. It's commonly found in natural conditions in riparian areas. It follows narrow bands up along stream channels and in larger concentrations in floodplains. But it is a disturbance species, and where you have timber cutting, road construction, house construction, other activities, it spreads greatly. And you can see the red alder in red here occupies a considerable portion of the landscape. It's a very vigorous nitrogen fixer. There's a huge range in the estimated nitrogen fixation rates. It's from about 20 to 300 kilograms per hectare. At the upper end of this range, this is high even by agricultural standards. The second source of nitrogen is domestic. This area's population has increased greatly. You have people living within the watershed areas, and then a large number of people concentrated along the shoreline, and this has increased in recent years. We have pretty good estimates how much nitrogen gets contributed per person per year. The most important, biggest source is the septic system, and Julie Horowitz will have more to say about that later this afternoon. And then we also have other lawn fertilization, pets, and other sources from the domestic. In addition, you also have, not mentioned here, is you have some fertilization of commercial forest land, but they only, in general, fertilize once per rotation, which is about 50 years. So we consider that a sort of a small contribution. And then we also have an atmospheric source. Many parts of the world, the atmospheric levels of nitrogen deposition have increased a lot. Due to the circulation patterns, it tends not to be so high here. We don't get the Eastern Europe pollution. We get a little bit of dust from Asia, but then we don't have a real good data on how much we're getting. We have one sampling station out on the Ho River, but otherwise we're sort of in a void as far as atmospheric sources. But we tentatively put it about 1.5 kilograms per hectare annually, which is low, but considering that it affects the whole watershed area, it makes up for about 10 or 12% of the total nitrogen inputs. And we have three areas that we're basically concerned with. The first is the watersheds, the areas with established streams. These are, in some ways, the easiest to deal with because we can go out and stick a bottle in the water and collect water samples. And we can measure the stream discharge and come up with estimates of how much nitrogen's getting in. But we also have areas along the shoreline here where the inputs to the canal are from groundwater or surface runoff and intermittent channels that are harder to sample. So if we assume that these areas are yielding about as much nitrogen as the areas we can sample on a per hectare basis, we can make reasonable assumptions of how much nitrogen is getting into the canal from these areas. More tricky is the shoreline areas, where we might think that something fundamentally different is going on just because you have tide action. You might have shortcutting of the normal biological mechanisms that reduce nitrogen loads before they get to the canal. And this is a far trickier area, and it's very difficult to sample. So what we did was we went out and we sampled, this is done by Peter Steinberg, one of Mike Brett's students. He sampled 43 rivers most of the sampling was done by volunteers. Peter sort of coordinated and did all the analysis on it. But we got a really good data set on how much water is coming in from the watershed areas. Peter did some statistical analysis looking at the estimated area of hardwoods from Landsat data and comparing the nitrogen loads from the areas that are most dominated by coniferous with ones that have the highest proportion of deciduous, which is mostly alder. And you can see that there's fairly high differences between the amount that's being yielded from the coniferous and the areas with the red alder. And similarly, with the population density, the areas with low population densities have much lower yields than the areas with high population densities. This is sort of an N members. You have the 10 lowest and the 10 highest in each case. And overall, he comes up with an estimated contribution from this analysis of about 17% due to on-site septic systems and domestic water use or domestic sources, and about 40% due to red alder. But there's several things that a monthly sampling can't really capture. And one is the variability through time. You go out and you capture once a month, and you're just getting a slice in time. The water level can change, the discharge can change greatly over that period, and then the solute the nitrogen concentrations in the water changes greatly. What happens is the nitrate, the mobile form of nitrogen, builds up in soils during dry periods. When you get a storm, it flushes out. Now this, keep in mind, these graphs are showing a concentration, not the overall flux. The concentration in the stream water goes up during the storms, especially early in the year, the top one. The concentration goes up, so you multiply the concentration by the discharge, and you're getting a very high flux during these early winter storms. It tends to, you see the greatest pulses during the early storms and less so later in the storms. And if you look at how much total nitrogen comes out, the vast majority of the nitrogen is coming out during these fall and winter storms. So the other thing we can incorporate these storms data into our monthly data and the storm data into our solute model, and we can play with various scenarios that we can't do with just sampling. And in order to do this, we used a paired model, a hydrological model, DHSVM, developed by Dennis Lettenmeyer's group and various students over time. in his laboratory. And then a solute export model developed by Purani Thanapakpuan as part of her PhD dissertation. And what the model does is it takes the various sources of nitrogen and feeds them in through the vegetation, the population, goes through the soil and through the geology and through the channel network. And we take the nitrogen sources. They're subject to various influences over time. When it first in the soil, it's subject to uptake by the vegetation, and then the bacteria that converts nitrate to nitrogen gas also in the soil. Probably most of it occurs within the groundwater, and then you also have certain amount of uptake by the periphyte and in the stream and through bacteria in the benthic area of the stream, leaving what comes out in Hood Canal, which is usually a fairly small percentage of what starts out, what is input to the system. And when we model it, we get a pretty good fit. The biggest variabilities, you see some in the winter, which is probably just due to when these monthly samples were captured, and then a certain amount of uncertainty in the summertime. But overall, a pretty good fit of our model to the measured concentrations. And when we put it all together, we end up with estimates of the contributing factors. We run the model, taking out the influence of people, taking out the influence of alder. We come up with estimates that are pretty close to what we estimated from the sampling. We end up with about 15 or 16% population, about a little bit less, we assume, from the alder in the model. But when we combine this with the marine information, what becomes immediately apparent is the watershed is a very small contribution to the overall flux of nitrogen in the Hood Canal. The water from the marine environment comes in about 0.5 milligram per liter nitrogen, which is way higher than anything you see coming out of the watersheds. In Hood Canal overall, the watersheds are only contributing a couple percent to the overall nitrogen. It's higher in Lynch Cove area. We estimate maybe 10 or 15%. But the other thing is that it's all coming in during winter storms. What comes in during the winter storm gets flushed out of the system. So this leaves us with a fairly small source coming in from the watersheds to Hood Canal. But what it does suggest is that what we really need to focus on is what's happening during summer storms. We see that most of it's coming in the storms, the winter storms, but even if it's only a small amount coming in the summer storms, if it's coming in when the nitrogen in the aphotic zone is depleted, it can make a big difference. So Nick Reed, who's been doing the winter storm sampling, is going to be extending his sampling into the summer, and we'll be able to get a better fix on how much is coming in through the summer storms. And then the other factor is the shoreline septic systems. Now, the thing that really distinguishes them is that a lot of them are subject to tidal action, and they're right near the water. So when the tide comes in, a lot of these things get, these septic systems on the shoreline get flushed with salt water, and we can go down, you can sample the septic systems, and there's salt water in them. It gets flooded when the tide comes in, and then when the tide goes out, it gets flushed out. And we think this might be short-circuiting the denitrification process, the anaerobic zones where the denitrification might be occurring. But the problem is that it's really hard to measure. We've been working with the USGS, Bill Simons, Rick Scheible, and others have been putting seepage meters. You can see one of them sitting there over on the right, and measuring the actual flux of water out of these areas, and then the flux of nitrogen. But we have a ways to go in reconciling our estimates based on watershed, what we know is coming out of the watershed, and what's coming in with these estimates. So there's still a lot of uncertainty, but we plug the different numbers in, and we can see that, depending on whose assumptions you use, that the shoreline areas are contributing a lot, or by far the most amount of nitrogen into the marine water. So that's where we are now. We can see that the watersheds in this area really don't matter that much. The shoreline areas and the summer storms are the areas that are that we can see right now are the most likely culprits if the terrestrial is the main source. So in the coming year, we're going to be incorporating the shoreline areas into our simulation model, doing additional field studies. And then we also, I just want to mention briefly, that we are expanding our modeling efforts into the rest of Puget Sound. We'll be dealing with some other issues, and less shoreline issues and more watershed issues, looking at nitrogen and the movement of toxics through the Puget Sound area, building on work by Dennis's students who've incorporated impervious area and sediment routing models into DHSVM. And then we also have a very exciting project going up on the Skagit Basin where we can play with alternative scenarios, looking at the development of the Skagit Valley, less the cities itself, but under various scenarios where agriculture is emphasized as the dominant development, or where maximized conservation, setbacks of the levees and planting of riparian areas, or whether the planning is geared towards rural residential development. And that's it. Yeah.
Are you familiar with the little Pocene project that just completed?
Is it?
If you are familiar with the little Pocene project.
I am not familiar with the little. The question was, are you familiar with the little Quilcene project? Is it a septic project?
Well, it was a very successful project. If you're familiar, you can tell everybody about it.
Oh, you know, I'm sorry. I'll look it up, but I don't know. Yes? The question is, why does the nitrate not get washed out in the summer? Why does it get washed out in the winter? Well, the winter is when most of the rainfall occurs. There's two things that happen in the winter. In the fall, the red alder senesces. It loses its leaves, and then the fine roots mostly turn over in the winter. So you have a large input of nitrogen through litter fall and fine root turnover, and you have low uptake by the vegetation. So this creates a seasonal high levels of nitrate in the soil, and when the rain falls, that becomes available to be washed out. But even though the amounts in the summer are low, it's still an open question whether some of that can be washed out if you have a summer storm. So that's still an open question, although it would be a small amount, much smaller than what you see in the winter. But it's pretty well established. In areas around here where it doesn't freeze, you see a pulse in the fall. In areas where it does freeze, you generally see the pulse in the spring during snowmelt. Yes?
Which toxics will you be looking at in Puget Sound?
You know, we're just getting into that, and I could get back to you, but we haven't spent much time with that yet. Yes?
How is projected sea level rise implicated in the flushing of Hood Canal?
How is sea level rise implicated in the flushing of Hood Canal? I don't know. I think it's an interesting question. We haven't gotten far enough to, and certainly the shoreline area, the septic tanks there, that certainly seems to be a very, very interesting, very pressing question, but we haven't gotten around to addressing it yet. I think it would sort of accentuate the problem if we're having now with a flushing by tidal action of the septic tanks. And then also, if we're getting increased winter storms, that would increase the flux during the winter, possibly, but probably not have too much in the summer. But the rise in sea level is definitely an issue. Okay? Thanks.